Welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. Today on the podcast, I had Christian Tooley, the founder of iCubed Investing, the first and only registered organization in the UK and Europe solely dedicated to querying venture capital. In today's episode, we talked about taking the dusty world of consulting into the sexy world of venture. Can you take the corporate out of corporate venturing?
We say a lot in our pitching material, we take the corporate out of corporate venture capital. Got it.
Angel investing with Ada Ventures in post-product pre-revenue companies in the UK.
I think the easiest way to put it would be it's like post-product pre-revenue.
Yeah, got it.
That's kind of like the stage we were looking at.
From the day job to the gay job, launching iCubed Investing, unlocking queer capital.
For example, we've done two unlocking queer capital events with Google, which was application-based, and we had a bespoke selection of funders, which was angels and VCs from our investment syndicate network.
Defining intersectional incredible founders and how iCubed Investing is partnering with Crunchbase to put a spotlight on your diversity. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode. And if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Christian, great to have you on the podcast.
Very excited to be here. Thank you.
Amazing. Let's dive straight in. You talk about your day job and your gay job. So let's start with the former. When most people think of Bain, they no doubt associate it with management consultancy, mm-hmm. and maybe even roll their eyes a little bit. I certainly would be in that camp. But you lead a team focused on venture and corporate innovation. So talk me through what that entails and what you hope to achieve personally and at Bain in the role.
Sure. So firstly, when I saw the role, I was like, okay, this is very unique, almost felt like a dream role, because I also have a similar point of view about certain management consultancies. So it has all of the rigor, intellect, and that strategic analysis of your classic strategy consultancy, but with all the sexy stuff around venture innovation, which was crucial for me, part of my job description to have a foot in the venture ecosystem, mm-hmm. keep evolving our network and building our brand. So what essentially we do is broken down into three topics, and I'll give an example of each to make it easier. The first is innovation strategy, and that's mostly working with Fortune 500 CEOs and venture leads. The second is business building or venture building, which is working with similar stakeholders. And the third is what we call VCAS, which is Venture Capital as a Service. And that's also working with CEOs, venture leads, but also fund managers within VC and PE. Mm-hmm. So an example of the first one, innovation strategy, and our clients and geographies are very varied, mostly EMEA focus, but saying that, last year we did projects in Silicon Valley and India. So it really depends on the client and their scope. But one really interesting project was we were working with one of the world's largest global coffee companies, mm-hmm. that wanted to explore how they could create an ESG strategy that embedded venture, and that was done in a more sustainable way than they'd previously done it. So that varied from looking at very early stage R&D of cellular grown coffee, mm-hmm. to vertical farming technologies and startups and how they can grow coffee in different terrains, in different environments, all the way down to farmer-centric ESG. So if they, for example, through certain ag tech products, deployed them in some of their farms in like East Africa, maybe that will be great for the E, but on the S, if there's no retraining and those are the local people that in that economy that rely on it, that's going to be an issue. So yep. That's one example of, I guess, more like pure innovation strategy. And the end goal there wasn't set. So for some of the companies, like when we were working with them, they were like, oh my God, we want to acquire this company.
Yeah.
straight, like,
yeah, fits, I mean, plug and play straight into
exactly.
Yeah.
For other ones, they were like, oh, we want to do more R&D. For different ones, they were like, oh, maybe we should set up a venture arm or do some sort of incubation for certain different companies. So that's on one end, the innovation strategy. In the middle, we've got venture building, which is like your classic what venture studios would do. A really interesting case there was working with one of the largest retail companies in India, who were specifically looking at retail pharma. Mm-hmm. So they'd recently made a lot of acquisitions of Western brands in the beauty cosmetics space and wanted to basically create a strategy on how they should move forward because it was a bit all over the place. And again, with that, we looked at everything from telehealth to the diagnostics journey for users in India, which is quite different to, say, the yeah. UK or the West, where they wouldn't necessarily go from, I have symptoms, let me go to a GP, they'll prescribe me something, then I go to the pharmacist. Sometimes they'd skip that step and go straight to over the counter, and yeah. they'd have the diagnosis there. So it was looking at that journey from a customer perspective, but also from a efficiency and efficacy perspective, because India, along with Brazil and China, has the largest amounts of counterfeit drugs.
Yep.
So then it was like, okay, there's certain blockchain traceability technology out there we could use to help get rid of that as a problem. Mm-hmm. And then they were exploring which of those ventures they wanted to actually set up and build themselves. Mm-hmm. And the last one, again, very different example, was a large holding company primarily in the energy services space. Mm-hmm. And we actually helped them set up $150 million climate tech CVC, purely looking at decarbonization. Mm-hmm. So that varied from coming up with their whole strategy and operating model, picking 10 investable themes, and basically finding the startups, doing the DD, pushing through the deals. So, yeah.
So that's the VC as a service,
exactly, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess so. That's a really broad kind of range of touch points. And like, you know, we've had, say, Founders Factory on the podcast mm-hmm. in the past, who obviously work quite closely with corporates, and have a venture studio mm-hmm. as well as the accelerator. I mean, CVC kind of keeps going in and out of favor. What are you seeing at the moment, I guess, right? Mm. Like, so one question I'd have is, obviously there was a lot of hubris and a lot of noise, mm-hmm. you know, late teens, early 20s around, you know, everyone wanted to be in venture. And then obviously over the last couple of years, we've seen a little bit of a yeah. pullback on that. Are you seeing the same sort of thing with corporate venture? Are companies still looking to externalize their R&D? Are they still looking at taking bets on smaller businesses, or have they started moving back to mm-hmm. Building their core R&D in-house? Like, how's that going?
So it's fairly mixed. There are quite a few players out there, mostly I'd say in like consumer products, telco, who are and continue to do this themselves, mm-hmm. which I think is really exciting and shows the potential. Some of them, I can't name because of client confidentiality, but they're also like doing consulting on behalf of other people in the ecosystem, which I think is really interesting. So if you've set up
corporate to corporate venture.
Exactly. Okay. Which kind of is obviously is what we do at Bain, but it's still great to see that they've had so much experience in CVC themselves and testing the market and being in the ecosystem for so long, they can now offer those advisory services. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, you still have those that, I guess they toy with the idea. I call it like broad brush venturing, because mm-hmm. everything we do is still venturing, whether it's innovation strategy or business building. It's venturing with the aim to innovate. So yes, not just
different flavors of
exactly.
innovation.
Yeah, yeah. It's not BAU just for the sake of returns. And there's a lot of corporates who see that as a great way to learn and to explore. I think those that take it too seriously and they're like, yeah, we want to set up a fully fledged CVC arm. We need X returns by this date. Like, that's not successful unless you have a very clear agenda of why you want to do this. But generally, I think it's a good way to play around if you have the balance leadership sheet, support and leadership, yeah, you're yeah. your own LP and you have that money. I think it's a great way to explore. And I find it, to an extent, sometimes maybe more interesting than traditional VC because you have that strategic rigor around it. It's not just placing multiple bets, but it's, okay, we want this to align to our, say, core business, but we also want to place a few bets that are completely out there. And it's a nice way to explore venture with that strategic undertone.
Yeah, I remember speaking to or attending a conference with Salim. I've forgotten his surname now, but Salim, who runs... Oh, I've forgotten the name of what he runs as well. Jesus.
Textiles?
No, not Textiles. No, this Exponential Organizations.
Okay.
Right? Which, again, is very much consulting into corporates. And I remember I was the only person from a kind of venture-ish background or startup background in this room full of corporate people. And I remember sitting down, there was sort of 12 of us in a group, and we'd had a... an assignment, if you like, to come up with a solution for something in particular. It was really interesting to me see, because there was a couple of guys who were like, no, we need to follow a process and do it this way. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of people that were like sort of really out of their comfort zone, didn't want to take the plunge into thinking about that. And there was me just saying, yeah, we should build vertical farms, which essentially was one of the answers that came out of the whole thing. But what I found was that, I guess there are two things, right? So A, at an individual level, you have people within corporate venture who potentially don't have, you know, having gone through a more corporate background, don't necessarily have the skill sets or that background, right? But then secondly, the organization itself, right? Like as a holistic organization, the way they talk about it, exponential organizations or whatever it's called, the way they talk about it is the corporate entity starts attacking the startup at the periphery. Do you think that's improved? Do you think corporates are able to, I guess, shake that cloak that they have of like, we are corporate, you've got to do things in our way, and accept the chaos that comes with venturing?
Yes and no. I think, like we always say, the best approach is obviously to keep an arm length approach. Like we say a lot in our pitch material, we take the corporate out of corporate venture capital.
Got it.
But I think, again, if I look at it across two levels, depending on the proximity to your core business that you make these investments at, if it's very close to your core, like the example I always give is B&W's core business would, say, be traditional petrol diesel cars. Adjacency would be more, you know, EVs. hybrid EVs, and completely new businesses would be like flying cars,
yeah,
which isn't completely out there. They've tested it in Singapore, doing stuff in California as well. So if you're doing corporate venturing and it's in your core business, you probably do need to stay a bit closer.
Got it.
If it's a bit further, it's good to keep that breadth
and space,
and give them the space. And also it depends where on the innovation continuum you are as well. So if it's very early stage R&D, or if it's late stage scaling commercialization, that would also
depict. So later stage, you're obviously going to be more corporatized in terms of your processes,
exactly.
But very early stage, you want to kind of keep that innovation going. So moving on, you've been in angel investing for ADA for some time now, ADA Ventures. We've previously had Matt Pennycard on, one of the founding partners on the pod before. How does investing as an angel via ADA work? And what is it that prompted you to join the program? And what lessons have you learned through the process?
Good questions. So firstly, I really like ADA, the founding team, their philosophy. When I did my application, I spoke very candidly about, I guess, my appreciation about how open they spoke about privilege as well. So Matt and Chek are great, and they spoke about the opportunities they had as a grounding to be able to set up ADA and the network they built, and this is one of the ways they want to give back. So that was a key reason. I genuinely do love the team, and I think what they're doing is great.
Yeah.
Secondly, their thesis is very aligned to my own impact-driven agenda and what I want to achieve with iCubed and through personal angel investing. In terms of the criteria, I mean, the main ones are UK-based companies and being broadly aligned to their three focus areas, which is climate equity, healthy aging, and economic empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, outside of the intersectional lens and wanting to give back to the queer community, I also want that impact lens as well. So for me, it was a it was an easy choice to make the application. In terms of what I learned, so I guess the first one is there is a lot of conviction and extra due diligence that's not really traditional due diligence that you need to do at such an early stage. So that was the actual other criteria. Obviously, it's like earlier stage companies.
Yeah, so it's pre-seed, seed at
yeah,
most,
I think the easiest way to put it would be it's like post-product, pre-revenue.
Yeah, got it.
That's kind of like the stage we were looking at. So I guess my decision-making, even though I had very clear in my head, this is the criteria I'm looking at, these are the types of companies I want, this is the journeys I want to see them go on, it wasn't as easy to make. And for example, one of the last checks I made, I knew that founder for a while. And when I first met him, I actually wasn't convinced of the business or the long-term plan for it. So we kept in touch, he was part of the iCube community. But then like I saw him pivot, he kept in touch, was a very good listener, and like really evolved into something where I then decided to be like, you know what? Yeah, I want to invest in you now. You know, you hear those stories of VCs will turn down a founder and be like, yeah, come back to us in 6 months. And sure. I'm always like, oh, is that just BS? But as an angel, I could see that and be like, yeah, that you need to sometimes maybe even see startups go on that journey. Even if you have early conviction, it will still be good to kind of test it out at the beginning to see, are they going to evolve that? Or are they really narrow minded and believing, no, we've got the strong conviction, we're not going to pivot ever.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few things there, right? Like we've had Matthew Stafford from 9Others on the podcast. And one of his criteria is that he won't make an investment the first time he meets a founder, right? So he ensures that he gets to know that founder over time. And again, to your point, sees them sort of grow. I guess it's more around like if the first time he meets them, they're pitching him, he won't invest. If he's known them for a while and then they pitch, you know, that's a different thing. But the second, the thing that strikes me, you know, to your point, and I think this is actually really interesting, right? And it was one of the things I kind of wanted to understand more. So as an angel investor, like a solo angel investor, i.e. investing off your own, from your own income or off your own balance sheet, you have the opportunity to take the bets that you want, right? You could take a bet on a mate because they're a mate. You could take a bet on a business that you really think is super interesting, but that's fully within your control. And a lot of angels would probably do less due diligence than they would admit to, possibly, you know, are far more gut driven, et cetera, right? So, but if you're angel investing through a fund or on behalf of a fund, I guess, that rigor, to your point, the diligence probably has to step up a level, right? Would that be fair, or is that?
No, it's definitely true. There's certain checkbox and standard due diligence criteria like I needed to do for ADA, then they would verify just because of, you know, the GPLP structure. Like,
of course,
that's true. I think at the beginning, it is very helpful because it helps you streamline your own due diligence process.
Yeah.
Then during the end, like in my last few investments, I was like, okay, I get the process now. It felt a lot more streamlined. So at the beginning, it was a bit more like using my own, obviously not completely, but gut-driven framework and the tick boxes I had in mind. And then combining that with ADA's framework that they gave a lot of training on to create kind of like a final output.
Got it.
So it was still in their format of like, this is like the due diligence document you need to fill out with my own like Christian iCubed flavor on top.
Yeah, got it. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because ADA obviously has, I think, the largest scout program in the country. It's obviously been quite active in setting up both that as well as the angel program. I mean, I have a question on that, right? Like I wonder whether, and anecdotally, I think this may be more to do with what I was seeing in sort of 21, 22, but it felt like the same deals were coming via multiple people all the time. Did you see like a lot of crossover? Do you feel like there was sufficient kind of breadth amongst either the angels or the scouts that actually it wasn't just everyone bringing the same deal to the table every day? Because the whole point, I guess, of scouting an angel and these programs is that you are looking for the outliers that other people aren't seeing, right?
So obviously I joined the scout and angel program a year ago, so I can't talk to like the few years before that, but there were a couple of crossovers and sometimes when people shared that, other people said, oh, I already spoke with them. I passed. I'm still interested. And it was useful to share due diligence and have that back and forth. But I wouldn't say it happened too much. And maybe, like, from what I understand, how they decided on the second batch of angels, because this is like the second version of their angel program, was access to different and unique communities. So it was less like, oh, I'm interested in health tech.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's all look at health tech. It's more like, no, I have access to a certain community that has different types of companies that they're building. So mine was obviously access to LGBTQ+. Yeah. There were others in different types of communities. So if it's community driven versus just generic sector expertise driven, it didn't happen too much, but it did happen, but it wasn't to an annoying extent, like, oh, we're all trying to scout like 10 deals. No, maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
Then we had a conversation and it was more interesting to hear their perspective and what they went through and sharing lessons learned and notes with each other.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, I wasn't specifically necessarily suggesting that it was happening at Ada, but I was seeing like there was a lot of scout communities that were kind of coming up over the last few years.
Yeah.
Everyone, again, wanted to be in venture. I mean, they all seem to have died down for the most part, other than Ada's, if I'm honest. But it's good because, I think... You know, where I think that is really valuable is precisely to your point, it's access to those different communities. I think Arthur Farouk is also an aide of Angel, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, she's been on the podcast before. And again, she's built community with Muz Makers. So again, she has access to a very different, cohort of potential founders. So, I mean, that makes sense. And I think I guess it also gives you the ability, you know, to actually take meaningful bets in businesses that, you know, you otherwise wouldn't necessarily be able to either get access to or have the capital to invest. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, that was the underlying reason for getting involved. Like, I wasn't in a position to say I can make like 5 or 10 really large investments beyond like minimum 1K ticket sizes that could make a difference or give me a fair bit of equity and give me the financial incentive as well as just like my philosophy to support these founders. So yeah, I would like to see more, to be honest. Like, now I'm like, oh, I want more money. What other VCs want to give me money to invest in? Like,
don't we all? I think that is the dream. Oh no, look, and I absolutely understand that. I mean, I have very similarly kind of write 1K checks, which, you know, I have conviction over, and it's great, but you also know that fine, the check itself isn't going to move the needle. Maybe the support you can give will.
Yeah.
But sometimes it would be great to be able to say, yeah, you know what? I'd love to write that 10, 20, 50K, whatever the number is, that check into this founder because they're really bloody awesome. And sadly, you know, that can't happen for everyone. Yeah. And I agree. I think, you know, if we think about venture as having been quite a closed shop ecosystem for many, many years, you know, one could argue still is to a large extent. It's quite gatekept. I think, you know, allowing other people to participate and to bring different views and to bring different, different investment opportunities to the table, hopefully is going to help the whole process. So let's talk about what you call your gay job, right? So why did you feel the need to found iCubed Investing? Mm-hmm. And I would love for you to talk me through where it's heading and what's in store for the future.
For sure. So there was a number of reasons I set it up. I know we alluded to it in the quick fire question. So firstly, there's lots of gay initiatives out there building communities, but they're very broad brush and generic. So they'll be like, oh, this is for gays in tech, gays in banking, creative gays, and was nothing out there for actual queer startup founders building day to day.
Yeah.
Like, not just like, oh, like me, for example, day job and gay job, but full-time gay job and day job is like building a company.
Just building, yeah.
So that was the first reason, which obviously led to us being the first registered financial service organization in UK and Europe. The next point was there was nothing intersectional. So a lot of the leadership and focus, whether directly or indirectly, and attendance of these other sorts of initiatives were your typical cis, gay, white men, often with a lot of privilege as well. And third point, a lot of the initiatives for me, that there wasn't really much practical output. Like some communities, I mean, there weren't many, but would organize like quarterly drinks, but that's about it. There was nothing there in regards to like partnerships or strategic initiatives. Which
it's
is
like it's a nod to the community, but not necessarily
exactly. Value it's like, oh, let's have drinks, and it'll just be a gathering of people. And I was like, where's the output? Where's the action? So our focus has always been like for the community to be intimate, mm-hmm. with the aim of scaling as many people as possible from community to capital. So as a baseline, in the community pillar, all queer founders and entrepreneurs can join, and they'll always have that as like as a baseline. Yep. When you're in that community, you have access to all of our ecosystem events, to any pitching events we do, to our queer founders forum, which is only for that community, to free perks and benefits and freebies from all of our partners. We've done two unlocking queer capital events with Google, which was application based, and we had a bespoke selection of funders, which was angels and VCs from our investment syndicate network. And after that, we had more than 50% of the attendees receive funding after that event. That's so amazing. Which is a really nice statistic to have. It wasn't just like, oh, come to a pitch day and pitch to like a room of 100 people and then put something on LinkedIn. It was like, no, it was speed networking, 10 founders, 10 investors, and like really intimate conversations, like quick 5-minute pitch, quick 5-minute feedback. And then afterwards they have the opportunity to keep in touch and we connected them all. So
can I ask a question, right? So with the founder community within mm-hmm. iCubed, define a fact, like, so are you open to, you know, entrepreneurs that are consulting, or do they have to be building like a venture scale business? Like what is that criteria?
Good question. So it is majority tech-based and venture scalable business, but we do have, for example, some people in the consumer product space that aren't traditionally like VC backable, but we're open to all entrepreneurs. But we always say with the caveat that the majority here are like startup tech founders and are looking for VC funding.
Yeah. Building a generational business of some nature.
Yeah, exactly. But that being said, there's some angels in our syndicate network that are open to all types of queer businesses, which is why, even though I think it will still end up being majority tech-founded startups, however, one of our long-term plans around building a queer marketplace is having all of your needs met by different queer businesses. So that's why I want to keep it open from that perspective.
I mean, to be fair... In any case, a founder that's building a consultancy today might be your next tech founder tomorrow. You just like that's the reality, right?
Yeah.
You want to catch as many as you can because you don't know where on their journey you've caught mm-hmm. them and where they may go. But sorry, you were talking about obviously the speed dating kind of side of things in terms of it, getting that, you know, matching that capital. And I think that's really important because, again, and we've had a lot of female kind of community mm-hmm. Founders on the podcast. and that linkage between just being a forum where you're able to share ideas to actually, this is a forum where you can share ideas, but also we can connect you with capital, I think is super important. And that often is the big problem. It's like, no, you don't need to tell me how to build this. Mm-hmm. I need to get funded. How do I do that? Right. So I think that's super, super important.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the first things that came out of our Queer Founders Forum, which we have an open session at the end. Like, what do you want to see from this community? Because, I founded it and I'm running it with a group of ambassadors now, but it needs to work for you. And one of the main things was like, access to, prepping for, pitching for, all around capital. Like, founders are very busy. So I was very conscious again of being like, oh, come for some free drinks here. Like there always had to be that practical output. And in terms of the future, which is very exciting, right now there's three key things and then what we want to do long term. So July 16th at Google's HQ in London, we have our inaugural IF, which is the Intersectional Incredibles Forum, which is an unconference for LGBTQ+ and migrant founders. So to unpack that a bit more, firstly, the title, Intersectional Incredibles. So I've spoken about this a lot whenever I talk about iCube. So it's our philosophy that if you are intersectional, meaning you have two or more currently or historically marginalized identities, your access to certain things in life may be more difficult, but that also provides you with a certain level of grittiness, resilience, and creativity that makes you a better entrepreneur. So that's, we say everyone in our community is an intersectional incredible. So that's the focus of the unconference. The reason we got migrants as well is I'm very conscious that a lot of DE&I initiatives are quite siloed. I think you do have to be quite advanced to say we have a intersectional council that includes everything from gender to sexuality to ethnicity to race to socioeconomic. There's still space, obviously, that warrants separate communities, which is why iCubed exists. But I want every year when we do IF for them to be an intersectional spotlight. And for me, migrants is an important one because I come from a family of migrants. Also, they're the backbone of this country, historically and politically. And right now we're in a day and age where politics is a shit show and we need to be supporting migrants and refugees.
And we can bag on Brexit. It's fine. I'm happy to do that anytime.
More than, yeah. I'm sure you just Google migrants in Google News UK now and you'll see some of the crap that politicians are coming out with.
We've got the Rwanda stuff going on and all the rest of it at the moment. But yeah, look, I mean, I think that intersectionality, often you'll find those traits coming together, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and especially if you are from a marginalized community, for whatever reason, right? Mm-hmm. You have to work harder. And often because you have to work harder, you will be more successful because you don't have necessarily the same opportunities that others have had, and you've just got to push yourself to be better, right, than people's expectations of you. And how large is that unconference going to be?
So it's going to be around 250 people. We're making it invite only. People can still register their interest, but we want to make sure we have the right people that can benefit the most there. So it'll be a mixture of founders, queer founders and migrant founders, funders, which will be a mixture of LPs, VCs, and angels, and friends. So anyone else from the ecosystem. But the first part of the day will be more your traditional conference style. The second half of the day will be purely unconference driven. So it'll be roundtable sessions that people can vote on as well to make sure they can dictate some of the content. And one of the outputs of that, which is another initiative we recently launched, is our EMEA survey for LGBTQ plus founders. And it's not just looking at what it's like to be a queer founder and investor relations and how much funding you've gotten, but also through self-evaluation questions that I've worked with a number of different researchers on for them to identify their levels of creativity, resilience, and innovation and really try and prove that thesis that intersectionality as a criteria for investment fosters innovation.
And
part of that, which is the third one, is we launched, which is really exciting, a partnership with Crunchbase, which is the first in the UK and Europe, to be able to tag on your Crunchbase profile as a founder that you're LGBTQ+, including loads of other diversity spotlights as well. So they have this in the US, but they've never done anything like the UK and Europe. So now any queer founder across the region will go to our website, which is spelled as i3investing.com/Crunchbase, and they'll be able to basically add that to their profile and complete the survey, then go back, change the /, to IF and register for the unconference.
Okay, that's nice plug there.
Yeah.
So Christian, actually one question that I have, I guess, out of this, right? And I was just thinking about it. I hadn't thought about it very deeply before, but obviously we see a lot of funds that launch that are focused on female founders. Mm-hmm. We have funds that, you know, often look at migrant founders. We have funds that are focused on the US versus the UK or, you know, geographical, et cetera. Yeah. Are there any LGBTQ plus VC funds out there, certainly in the UK or Europe, that are specifically focused on?
So in the UK, no. There's one based in Berlin and there's a couple in the US that are more broadly focused on different intersectionalities, but they do mention LGBTQ+. So from those out there, the main criteria is like ticking that intersectional box.
Yeah.
But it's standard VC backable businesses.
Of course.
So obviously we include that. But for me, what wakes me up in the morning and gets me out of bed is the fact that they're intersectional. They have a degree of innovation and impact and across all they're investable. So that's kind of the unique formula. Like I don't just want to back a bunch of, for example, like gay white men that are building SaaS companies for fintech, which for some funds out there would mean, oh, we tick our box. It's LGBT, like without the Q plus and VC backable. But it's more like working on those companies that are actually making a broader difference, which to be honest, if you're not building a company that doesn't have a focus maybe broadly on climate and health, for example, then what you're doing, it's 2024. We need that now. We need those types of businesses more than ever.
I mean, more generally speaking, the conversations I have with VCs and what I see in the market in any case is there is less, I think there is less capital flowing towards just pure B2B SaaS type business. I think people are now not waking up. I think capital is being deployed into very heavily R&D focused businesses, which tend to fit climate, hardware, deep tech, et cetera. And I think there are some really interesting, you know, opportunities that are coming up. I mean, I was speaking to a founder the other day who's built, you know, who was in traditional manufacturing. He's now built additive and precision manufacturing for car, auto, and aero, right? Just raised some funding, you know, and really kind of rocket shipping. And one would imagine that, and I think the point is, right, these businesses can and will be built by anyone. I think the problem is always that if you come from, as you call it, an intersectional background, your ability to raise funding is markedly lower, right? Like we know that the statistics show that they're markedly lower, right? So I think being able to shine that spotlight, highlight, and hopefully funnel these founders through to that capital, I think is really positive.
Just on that, one thing I'd add is, which obviously is important, access to the capital at the bottom. We have a concept at IQ called the queer capital triangle. So at the bottom, you have queer founders trying to get capital. Above that, you have investors deploying capital. And obviously above that, you have their LPs.
Yep.
So like the higher up you get, the more narrow it is.
Yeah.
And obviously the capital flows from the top down. So that's things like the angel program that was on, like, also great, but really needs to start at the top if you want to see systemic change.
No, so yes, but no. So I'm going to disagree slightly, but not really. So, I mean, I've talked about it a ton of times on this podcast. It doesn't matter what diversity you're trying to create. What you need is diverse LPs, funding diverse GPs, funding diverse founders, building diverse teams, having meaningful exits that then allow their employees and those teams to recycle the capital back to the top. The problem in the UK and Europe is we just don't see enough of that. Like certainly not the meaningful sort of numbers that you do see in the US. But yes, 100%, obviously at the top of that, at the top of the pyramid, it's narrow. And the more work that can be done to kind of broaden that base, the better. Finally, what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home, what is a hill that you would die on defending and hopefully you won't get cancelled for?
Yeah. So I was trying to think about this because there's lots of stuff, some that maybe is appropriate, some that isn't.
Yeah.
I don't know if this counts as that, but I think a lot of people think of queer history and LGBTQ plus as a recent thing. Post-60s, after the Stonewall riots, and before that, it just didn't exist. Whereas if you look at the history of humanity from Celtic Viking times in the UK, for example, where traditional, what we consider now female gender roles would be held sometimes by like a gay person in that relationship. Also, all the way through to Roman and ancient Greek times, obviously there was a lot of power involved. But the other area people don't realize as well is in other parts of the world, how it existed untarnished pre-colonialism and pre the spread of capitalism. So like hijras in India which now are under attack. I don't know if you've seen the latest Dev Patel movie that covers that a lot, which is really important.
Okay.
And they parallel that with also the rise with like Hindu extremist nationalism and how it's just like any community that's not that. So whether it's trans or Muslim, there's a lot of suppression there. And also during the Islamic Golden Age, which I think a lot of people associate anything Islamic and Arabic with like anti-gay. But if you look at 14th, 13th century, like Sufism and like the amount of like very, very gay poetry and lifestyles that existed there, like the likes of
bloody,
Rumi, etc.
It's bloody good poetry.
I mean, it's good poetry as well, and it's queer as fuck. Yeah. So I would say, yeah, that's probably it. When people try and use that as an argument, be that in the West or outside of the West, when they're like, oh, they uphold previous British colonial laws and say, no, this is not part of our culture or religion. I'm like, well, it has been historically. Like, you're just having backlash.
You've just decided to ignore it. Yeah.
Because of your own extremist interpretations or because of your response to colonialism as well. And I think together they create this. Yeah.
Well, it comes back. It basically plays into the lifestyle choice argument, right? Because if you can say it's a recent phenomenon, then essentially what you're saying is, well, okay, people have decided, because evolution hasn't changed, it's just too small a time span, so therefore it must be a lifestyle choice. Whereas actually, as you say, and look, I mean, going back into history, even if you look at Hindu scriptures, and not to turn this into a religious podcast, but if you look at Hindu scriptures, right, and you have Shiva, he is often depicted as the cosmic androgyn, right? Like he is half male, half female. Yeah. It's a core part of the philosophies of the ancients, that these were actually quite natural, right? And to your point, whether it's Greek, Roman, or elsewhere, the prevalence, I guess, or the acceptance, I think, is maybe a better way, of differences in gender roles and how different people would come together was far more accepted than it is today. And I think, yes, to your point, like, a lot of that has been driven by, I guess, Western imperialism, the rise of Christianity as kind of the basis for law for many Western countries. 100%. Etc. I take that as a contrarian conviction. I'll bank that one. Christian, it's been absolutely incredible having you on the podcast. For our guests, or for our audience rather, where's the best place for them to find you online? You're on LinkedIn, Twitter. Where can they find you?
So LinkedIn, Christian Tooley, and Instagram at TWOLEY Street. So Tooley Street, but start with the TWO.
Okay,
I'm avoiding Twitter, X, whatever people call it now. It's too many platforms. Instagram, LinkedIn, and if you're lucky, WhatsApp.
I'm back on Twitter. I also downloaded AirChat and not entirely sure what I'm doing on there. So yes, I do agree, there are too many platforms. Christian, it's been absolutely amazing having you here. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.